Hello, and welcome to Distillations, weekly extracts from the past, present, and future of chemistry. I'm Robert Hicks. Each week, we bring you stories on all things chemical, from boron to baseball. In this week's show, we're talking about sports. We'll learn about a miracle fabric that is changing athletic performance, and look back at steroids through the ages. That's all coming up on today's episode of Distillations. At first glance, it might seem that not much has changed about sports since the Greek soldier Pheidippides ran the original marathon in 490 BC. Runners, after all, still run. But while the emphasis on physical activity remains a constant, it seems that all the accessories have changed. Both professional athletes and dedicated amateurs spend billions of dollars every year on specialized athletic equipment, shoes, clothing, muscle relaxants, nutritional supplements, and performance-enhancing drugs. In today's show, we're taking a close look at the chemistry behind these sports add-ons. First up, in today's Element of the Week, Jennifer Dionisio explores an element-rich tropical fruit that may or may not have an impact on athletic performance.
At the finish line of most endurance events, competitors find piles of bagels and bananas along with the trophies and ribbons. The bagels, we all know, are there to provide carbs. But why bananas? Bananas are a particularly good source of potassium, one of the essential electrolytes the body loses when we sweat. Potassium has many roles in the body, including heartbeat regulation and muscle function, which has made many athletes blame low potassium levels for painful and performance-sapping cramps. Another group of cramp sufferers, low-carb dieters, blame a lack of potassium for causing their pain. Bananas, along with other potassium-rich foods like oranges and potatoes, don't make the cut in the strict diet regime, and many adherents of Atkins-type diets believe this is the source of their painful leg cramps. Potassium pills are a poor substitute. The supplements available in local drugstores don't actually contain much potassium, typically only 3% of the recommended daily allowance. Ironically, concentrated levels of potassium can be dangerous to the body. Although experts can't agree on whether potassium is the true cause of athletes' or dieters' cramping, they do agree that most recreational athletes have little to worry about. Only sustained, high-intensity exercise is likely to deplete the body's store of potassium to a dangerously low level. So enjoy that banana, but recognize that you might not actually need it. And that's it for the Element of the Week. I'm Jennifer Dionisio.
Major League Baseball's steroid scandal is only one of the many doping incidents to make the front page recently. These days, we hear about performance-enhancing drugs in every conceivable sport, from traditional testosterone-heavy events like weightlifting and football, to speed-based sports like biking and sprints. But it turns out that steroids have a long history. To find out more, CHF's Audra Wolf spoke with John Hoberman, author of Testosterone Dreams: Rejuvenation, Aphrodisia, Doping.
Thanks for talking with us, John, and welcome to Distillations.
I'm very glad to be here.
You've written a book about testosterone, which was first synthesized in 1935. What were some of the things that it was being used for at that time?
The very first and most important use of synthetic testosterone was the treatment of so-called hypogonadism, or a condition where the male's body does not create enough testosterone of its own. It was being used to treat breast cancer in women. It was being used to treat oversized prostate glands. It was being used to treat the male climacteric, the early term for male menopause. It was being used to treat acne, to treat uterine bleeding, gynecomastia, the excess of fatty tissue in the male breast, premature orgasm, senility, sterility, you name it.
Were you surprised by any of these uses?
Yes, I was surprised by this range of uses because this was really groping, exploratory pharmacological medicine, and it would not have occurred to me that they would immediately apply synthetic testosterone drugs to such a wide and sort of indiscriminate range of disorders.
How was testosterone being prepared before the synthetic version became available?
What the scientists did was to take an animal testicle, for example, a dog or a guinea pig, or a male cow, and to, in effect, distill as best they could the so-called male chemical or factor out of this enormous mass of material. The next step before the actual synthesis of testosterone was the collection of thousands and thousands of liters of urine from males. For example, the urine produced by the men at a police station. And through this long and very odoriferous process, the testosterone itself would finally be crystallized into this tiny mass of material deriving from thousands of liters of male urine.
That must have been very expensive.
I would assume it was expensive and even more time-consuming than that. Finally, in 1935, the synthesis was achieved in a European laboratory as a result of a competition between three labs that were essentially racing against each other, each of which was financed by a drug company.
That's fascinating. Now, when did athletes start using testosterone?
As far as we know, the first use of testosterone and its derivatives, anabolic steroids, begin in the early 50s. It is known, for example, that at least some Russian weightlifters by 1954 were using. By the 60s, anabolic steroid use in track and field in professional football is spreading more and more, and by the 70s, it is established practice.
Would you say that doping agents have transformed modern sports?
They absolutely have transformed modern sports. And over the past 10 years, we've learned a very great deal about the much greater extent of anabolic steroid use among many, many elite athletes in a variety of disciplines than we ever knew before.
So I think that's all we have time for today. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Glad to do it.
John Hoberman is professor of Germanic Studies at the University of Texas, Austin. Have comments or questions about something you've heard on our show? Send your thoughts to distillations@chemheritage.org. You're listening to Distillations. I'm Robert Hicks. When you go out for a jog or hop on your bike, what do you wear? Chances are it contains spandex, the artificial fiber, often referred to by its trade name, Lycra, is at the core of the wardrobe of any athlete, from weekend warrior to Olympic contender. Blended with cotton, wool, nylon, or a host of other man-made fibers, spandex gives garments a firm stretchiness. But it turns out that spandex can also offer a performance edge. Erin McCleary has more in this week's Chemistry in Your Cupboard.
Years ago, on a group bicycling trip to Mount St. Helens, a fellow cyclist pulled me aside at the summit to critique my outfit. I thought I had cobbled together appropriate gear for that windy, rainy day, but this more experienced cyclist vehemently disagreed, because I was not wearing spandex. Invented in 1959 at DuPont, spandex is made up of long-chain polymers with soft, rubbery segments alternating with rigid segments. The soft segments allow the fiber to stretch up to 600%, while the rigid segments provide strength. Originally used in girdles as a substitute for rubber, spandex continues to shape many a foundation garment and its wearer. But since its first use in athletic attire by the French Olympic ski team in 1968, it has also shaped many silhouettes in sports. A Swiss company claims to have invented the first spandex cycling shorts during wind tunnel testing of early carbon fiber bike frames in the mid-1970s. The project engineers found that the aerodynamic advantage of their new frame was counteracted by the drag from riders' wool clothing, the traditional material for cycling gear. They then conducted tests with a naked rider, but found that bearskin creates drag as well. Working with a manufacturer of downhill ski racing suits, they created a tight spandex suit that did succeed in reducing drag. From that skin-tight suit, it was but a short leap to tight spandex cycling shorts. Lightweight, comfortable, and easy to wash, spandex shorts were quickly adopted by professional cyclists and are now ubiquitous among professionals and amateurs alike. Spandex has had an even more dramatic effect on the attire of Olympic swimmers. A full-body spandex and polyester suit, billed by its maker Speedo as the fastest swimsuit ever made, created controversy when it was introduced in 2000. Speedo claimed that by emulating the characteristics of shark skin, the spandex suit reduced drag. The latest version of this suit, which will be worn by the U.S. swim team in the Beijing Olympics, was developed in conjunction with NASA and purportedly reduces drag even further. 19 course records have been broken by swimmers wearing this suit since February of this year, leading to cries by angry swim coaches that the suits amount to technological doping. So remember, when you pull on that spandex cycling jersey or those spandex running tights, it's chemistry that may be giving you that winning edge. For Distillations, I'm Erin McCleary.
Erin McCleary is curator of exhibits at the Chemical Heritage Foundation. And that's it for this week's episode of Distillations. Today's quotation comes from Damon Hill, English race car driver. Winning is everything. The only ones you remember when you come second are your wife and your dog. Distillations is a presentation of the Chemical Heritage Foundation and is made possible by the generous support of the Richard Lounsbery Foundation. Mia Lobel is our senior producer, with help this week from Lissa Rome. Our assistant producer is Victoria Indeviro, and our executive producer is Audra Wolf. Our theme music is composed and performed by Dave Kaufman. Additional music provided from the PodSafe Music Network. Check it out at music.podshow.com. Please tell us what you think about our program and send suggestions for future shows to distillations@chemheritage.org. Until next time, I'm Robert Hicks.